Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour Zero Point radio show. This show focuses on discussions of mystical and spiritual psychology, the study of the esoteric traditions, and comparative studies with modern science, and also we involve social political commentary in this talk show. My name's Christopher Holmes. I'm a PhD clinical and forensic psychologist, and have studied now in the mystical traditions for at least 30 years of my life. In the background, I have James Moffat, and Jim acts as a co-host and also widely studied and read in the mystical traditions and science and generally a wide breadth of knowledge of political and cultural phenomena. Jim, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Chris?
Okay. Good.
I was just listening to that description of myself. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it. I had to come up with something.
Yeah, well, that's nice. Thank you.
Okay. My website is at www.zeropoint.ca, and I invite listeners to have a look at my writings posted to my site. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to revise it and post new web pages lately. I don't quite understand what my problem is in being able to do that, and I hope to deal with that this week, as I've been trying to revise my site now for several weeks. Okay, I'm not sure. Today I thought we'd have a more open show. We don't have a guest on. We've had a series of guests over the last 2 months. We've had friends from the Theosophical Society, primarily in the United States, and we had about four or five shows on the teachings of Theosophy from a variety of perspectives over the last month. So today we'll continue with discussions of Theosophy, but I'd like to open it up, and I'll give out the number for any people who would like to call in and call in on any topic or questions or commentary on any past shows. In the States, the number is 877-876-5227. And in Canada, it is 888-815-9756. Okay. Jim, any thoughts on past shows? Or
well, there was a direct line, I think, that Don told us too, which is 530-876-3222.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I didn't catch that number when he was saying that.
Yeah.
That was the direct number.
Well, we had a little quick discussion with Don just before we went on the air, which is interesting, and he was talking about the archives of the shows, and I didn't realize that that was actually a something that we could address, was to maybe just give a description of each of the previous shows. I mean, it's quite an interesting archive. We have a lot of material on there, so I mean, at some point I'll start trying to go through them and even just provide a generic synopsis of what even the guests and just what the topics might be.
Yeah, it would be excellent to do.
Yeah, yeah. I've been meaning to a long time ago. I started listening to the archives and haven't done so for a long time. It's interesting what you were just talking about your website, and I'm in the midst of writing this book, The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, which is an examination of the alleged conflict between science and religion from a mystical and esoteric perspective, and which gives an overview of the history of your work and your theoretical position on the nature of consciousness. And I was going gung-ho there for a couple of months, and I just sort of hit a wall. I mean, part of it is I had to sort of stop and start to do some further reading to gather some material together. But it's interesting, when you're working, how it's like what Gurdjieff speaks about in terms of the law of seven, is that nothing, or the law of the octave, that nothing unfolds in a continuous, uninterrupted fashion, that there are certain breakpoints and things where you need a shock to keep the process going, or it'll start to deviate, or it'll stop, or it'll distort. And I see that more and more in kind of my own work processes, eh? Like how I just think, like, well, there's no way that I can't continue to keep this momentum going, and then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, things just kind of come to a halt, you know, or they start to go sideways a bit, and that's when you really have to, if you're going to pursue something, you have to really kind of put your, you know, your head down, and you have to try to mobilize yourself in a sense. Don't you find that with your work, like with your writing?
Yeah. I mean, I was working very intensively at revising or finishing the book God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine before I went to California.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was there for, I guess, 10, 11 days, and then I came back, and when I arrived back, they had the Security Prosperity Partnership on in Ottawa.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With the three banditos there, and at Montebello, Quebec, and I was out for the protests for that. And it was kind of such a whirlwind, and then since then, I was supposed to do another set of revisions on my book there, and had felt a complete block around it. I just have had no energy to go back into it. It's like those cycles sometimes, and sometimes you need that break and shift the focus.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, today was the first day I started getting back and got through 40 pages of re-editing it. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, I want to try to work through it this week. I don't think it needs a lot. And next week, we'll have on John Dreas, I hope, who's a scientist who had contributed a paper to the 1984 Symposium on the Secret Doctrine.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he has a copy of my book and kind of disagrees with aspects of my arguments. So I hope to have him on and discuss that work again, the metaphysics of the Secret Doctrine. We'll go into that next week with him.
Yeah, interesting. What kind of, just, you know, and roughly, what kind of things does he disagree with? Does he just disagree with you substantively, or are the more fine points in terms of interpretation?
Well, actually, I don't really have a sense of it yet.
Oh,
I don't grasp that.
Uh-huh.
He mentioned one thing, but when he mentioned it, it didn't seem to me that was inconsistent with what I was saying anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So it was more an interpretive emphasis a bit. Well, but anyway, so next year I'll really try to go into a little bit of the holographic physics of the Secret Doctrine and explain some of that more technical aspect, and hopefully John will be on to contribute to that. And then I guess the show after that, Jim, you'll be doing with Odin.
Right.
And you'll be interviewing Robert Bruce.
Right.
Yeah, I hope you got that link I sent.
Yes, I got that, thanks. And
yeah, fascinating individual, wide experience of the subtle dimensions and writings on them.
Yeah.
That should be quite interesting.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting.
Yeah.
Just in general terms, why don't you tell people a little bit about what your book is about your you know, your book about divine mysteries, and what's the actual title? Sorry,
it used to be called Divine Mysteries,
right?
And then before, in preparation for the California conference, I got back into revising the book and added 60 to 70 pages to it. And the title is God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine.
Oh yeah.
So the basic argument. Well, I'm trying to explain aspects of the Secret Doctrine of Madame Blavatsky, published in 1888. And in my focus on the Secret Doctrine, I've grasped the significance of her concepts of zero points, or she also calls them Laya centers. And it is said that any living cosmos has a zero point or Laya center. So we as living beings have these zero-point centers. That's why, as you know, I call it Zero-Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science.
Right.
Drawing this concept from Blavatsky. Now, in the Secret Doctrine, she doesn't go extensively into the nature of secret of zero-points, but what references there are have this kind of profound parallel to new concepts emerging in physics. So, but I mean, there are many, many parallels between Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine and modern physics, beginning with what in physics is called vacuum genesis, or creation out of nothingness, and how the quantum vacuum is seemingly empty but really is the plenum, and there's an infinite amount of energy and information latent within space. So those concepts in modern science are equivalent or similar to Blavatsky's concepts. And she described the origin of the universe from a point source, which is similar to modern physicists' description of the universe as emerging from a singularity condition. And Blavatsky described there as being a seven-dimensional eternal parent space, which in modern terms would be equivalent to a seven-dimensional hyperspace. And we find that, indeed, a model of seven-dimensional hyperspace is in the newest theories in physics. There's so many profound parallels between Blavatsky's view and ideas in modern quantum physics and cosmology. So in the book, I try to give an overview. And so it deals a lot with zero points and singularities and the nature of the quantum vacuum and, you know, the newest ideas in physics. So my work tries to compare Blavatsky's secret doctrine to the newest concepts in science, and asking the question about the existence or non-existence of God. Because in a way, Blavatsky's secret doctrine, it provides a model of intelligent design. Because she's actually explaining the dynamics by which she says the spiritual or divine intelligences, the way in which they manifest physical reality. So she actually provides a model of that. In a way, it's called a model of divine micro-intervention. So I'm actually trying to explain the secret doctrine and explain how it's a model of intelligent design. Because you hear people today in the science versus religion debate, some people argue for the existence of God, and others deny the existence of God. But it's never, the issue's never considered in a substantive way, in a scientific way. It's only a matter of belief or disbelief. Whereas if you have the Blavatsky secret doctrine, you actually have a theory of what she postulates concerning metaphysical causes. So I'm trying to examine Blavatsky's work in a scholarly way while looking at the question of the existence of God. That's the basic thrust of the God science and the secret doctrine. Jim.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a comment to like to make on that. Well, it's certainly, a couple of things that, as you say, the secret doctrine was published in 1888, and Madame Blavatsky was, is generally acknowledged within esoteric and mystical circles to have been one of the great, if not the greatest modern scholar of esotericism and mysticism, and you know, there's a lot of controversy surrounding her in terms of whether or not she had duped certain people, and you know, she was accused of various transgressions and found guilty by the British Society for Psychical Research. But the question that remains is, how exactly did this woman, and you know, she was also accused of plagiarizing, but the fact remains that somehow she had this incredible wealth of information which she brought together, and a lot of it obviously is thousands and thousands of years old, and yet she was able to, in 1888, to say, you know, that this is the essence of the metaphysical nature of reality and the spiritual dimensions of reality, and really anticipated key findings in 20th century physics, which is in and of itself quite extraordinary, you know. And it's interesting how what a lack of curiosity there is, intellectual curiosity about this phenomenon. First of all, people don't know it. That's the first problem. But even amongst those who have some sort of familiarity, it's like, well, for instance, you know, Peter Washington, who wrote Madame Blavatsky's Baboon, which was a critical look at teachers such as Blavatsky, Gurdjieff, Rudolf Steiner, Krishnamurti, he deals with their lives and he tells interesting stories about them, but he never really deals substantively with what they taught. And yet, you know, if you're really going to talk about these people, you have to talk about their teachings. And that just raises so many questions about the history of human knowledge, the history of esotericism and mysticism, and what the nature of that, you know, what the nature of that approach to studying reality is. Because, you know, as I say, one of the other things, it anticipates so many developments in modern physics. But one of the other things, too, as I mentioned in a previous program, when I read Blavatsky, what really strikes me, and it's the same thing with Gurdjieff, is when they'll make statements about things, and there's a aura of authority about them, and it's inherent in the way that they present themselves and the way they articulate what they're saying. And Blavatsky says, you know, people aren't going to believe this, but you wait, you know, you'll see. And I think really the latter half of the 20th century has vindicated much of what she said.
Yeah, it has. It lets us understand it. The new science lets us understand the secret doctrine in a wholly different way.
Yeah.
And especially this concept of zero-point centers.
Yeah.
And how profoundly that is, important that is. And also the idea of ethers. Like in modern science, we dismiss the idea of the ether back in the early 1900s when they couldn't discover an ether drift.
Right.
But then in modern times, people have realized that the quantum vacuum or space itself is essentially an ether. And there's an inherent nature to space when you go down to levels of Planckian units and such. So that there is now, they call it the quantum ether, or they have this seven-dimensional hyperspace is their ether. Well, that's another idea that Blavatsky, like she explained, that was one of her most essential teachings, was that there's this ultimate ether or akasha, and it is seven-skinned. So when creation manifests, the seven planes of existence are created out of this seven-dimensional hyperspace. And this pattern of creation, the sevenfoldness, is embodied in all these different media and in different world orders. So her concepts about the ether and the concepts about the zero-point centers are so profoundly interesting. And I'll give one example that I developed in the book this time that I'm not sure you're familiar with, Jim, which is, in studying modern science, I see how they regard gravity as the basic principle in science which leads to the creation of world order. By that, I mean, for instance, after the Big Bang and you have these huge kind of massive clouds of matter scattered throughout space-time, it's according to the law of gravity that these begin to condense and be drawn to each other and form into what will become galaxies or galactic clusters. And then within the galaxies, say for instance with the formation of the solar system, they think that that is due to the effect of gravity and that the sun is at the center of the solar system and it's by gravitational influence that it holds the planets in orbit around it. So in modern science, the force of gravity is regarded as kind of the cause of galactic formation and the formation of solar system and so on. And then you come to Blavatsky, and Blavatsky states that gravity as such does not exist. That there is no such thing as gravity, and she states that the gravity is really due to electromagnetic fluxes in the ether of space. So she was saying this a century ago. Now, well, as it happens, in the newer physics, in the newest physics, the models of the nature of the quantum vacuum, they now consider that gravity indeed may not exist, but it may be a variation of the electromagnetic force, and that gravity is due to electromagnetic fluxes in the quantum ether or in the zero-point fields. So this newest concept of gravity, which has emerged, is exactly what Blavatsky was saying over a century ago. So if then we consider, like, in science, there's this question of the search for dark matter. Now, how this search for dark matter came about was a scientist studying distant galaxies determined there wasn't enough visible matter in the galaxies to be holding them together, according to the law of gravity. Okay, and because of the missing matter, the galaxies should be torn apart, but instead they hold together. So they assume there has to be dark matter within the galaxy. So the search for dark matter began. Now, see, the search for dark matter is predicated on the concept that it's the law of gravity that holds the galaxy together. Okay, and then if the law of the galaxy is a formative law, then there's not enough matter. But when you come to Blavatsky, so for Blavatsky, she would say that a galaxy has a zero-point center. It has a life center, and it's the electromagnetic fluxes propagated through the ethers which bind the galaxy together through electromagnetic influences. So in that case, it's electromagnetic influences that hold and bind that galaxy together. And there's a sense in which it is a living whole. So it's the presence of a zero-point life center that organizes nature and gives form to nature. And it's not produced by the effects of gravity. Okay, that's pretty complicated, I guess, too.
I think that was well stated. It's interesting because, even in terms of gravity, you know, like, Newton was really troubled by gravity, eh, because it implied action at a distance, and he, you know, even though he devised, you know, derived the laws of gravity, he never, in a way, like, it always kind of struck him as being somehow wrong. I mean, I know that just reading about him, that he had certain qualifications about, you know, whether or not this was actually the proper description of what was going on, even though mathematically it conformed to, you know, to the theory. There was some reservation about it, and it's interesting that, you know, that this idea that it could be being produced it's an effect which is caused on some more subtle level is really interesting. I mean, that's what basically you're saying about Blavatsky's descriptions of the seven-skinned eternal space is that there are all these underlying realms, which in modern physics would be the quantum vacuum or hyperspace, but that they're beyond physical measurement, and yet they're somehow intimately connected with the manifest material physical world that we can measure and that we operate in.
Yeah, and the new views of science, it's like they regard what is manifest physical reality as like small excitations on the sea of infinite energies.
Yeah.
And so what we see is really sustained by this vast, interconnected, deeper dimensional web of interrelationship between things. You mentioned the idea of non-local influences, and that's interesting. Like, here's another example of how Blavatsky compares with modern science. Like, generally, modern scientists have always hated the idea of non-local effects. They abhor at the concept of action at a distance. So they tend to like to think that if one quanta, particle A, for it to communicate with another particle, quanta B, they have to exchange a virtual particle. So a virtual particle manifests out of the quantum vacuum and carries that influence from one particle to another. So So in modern physics, all the forces of nature have these virtual particles that carry the field influence of that force of nature. So the electromagnetic force has photons which carry the electromagnetic influence. So the idea, physicists like to think that for one particle to affect another, it has to be mediated by the exchange of a messenger particle. Okay, now in quantum physics then, what happened with Einstein's paradox, the EPR paradox, was this idea that if you had two quanta in a singlet state and they were split apart, and you measure one quanta, hence collapsing its wave function, then you instantaneously determine the state of the second particle. Now, the idea, though, is that when you collapse the wave function of the first particle, it doesn't send a messenger particle over to particle B. No, instead, when you collapse first particle wave function, the other collapses instantaneously, and there's no propagation of a messenger particle. So it's non-local effect. So this idea of non-local effects is absolutely inherent to quantum systems. So whereas physicists hate the idea of non-local effects, the existence of non-local effects is implied, it's implicit within quantum theory itself. Now what's interesting when I look back at the Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky says that at one point in the Secret Doctrine, she says in reality, ultimately there are no phenomena produced solely by local effects. All phenomena involve action at a distance, Blavatsky states. Now, how to explain? I can't really explain that too well. It's trying to understand. Blavatsky has a holographic view of the nature of reality, and she says at one point that there is one omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. So this implies that if you take any point in space, there's an omniscient thrilling through that point. So everything we see exists within this field of all this higher dimensional intelligence and information that interconnects all the material things. Everything exists in this sea of infinite energy. And so all things involve this underlying non-local sea of influence.
That's the way I kind of understand things. That what little I do understand is that, as you said, it's a field, right? There's like this underlying field. And somehow everything in manifest creation is, in a way, it's being generated and being sustained and being informed and resolving back into this underlying field. So, like, in a sense, that's how I would interpret that statement,
yeah.
that there are no real local effects. I mean, this is interesting, too. I'm in a philosophical level in terms of, for a couple of reasons. I mean, number one, David Ray Griffin, in his books, argues that he bases his critique of modern mechanistic, materialistic, reductionistic science on the theories of Alfred North Whitehead, a philosopher and scientist. And one of the things he emphasizes over and over again is how non-local effects are just not allowed at all in the materialistic, mechanistic, reductionistic framework. They don't fit, and yet there they are. And so that's why I think in part there's such resistance in a way within scientific circles to admitting the possibilities that non-local effects imply, like the idea of like some sort of higher intelligence informing everything and in these fields. Like, I mean, in a way, like, people must know this, but it's like they don't want to accept the implications of it because I think they think it threatens so much of their understanding of things. But in a way, it doesn't. It's not going to. it leads to a more comprehensive picture of things. And if in the process, you know, you have to admit spirit and some sort of spiritual intelligence, that really doesn't, that doesn't do away with the reality of describing things in another frame of reference, like the materialist frame of reference. But it provides a more comprehensive and complete perspective. And I mean, that's why I say, in a sense, like this debate between religion and science, or this conflict, like somebody said, it's like a feud, you know, and it's between kind of fundamentalist interpretations of religion and science. And I think if you, what's so interesting is that if you have a perspective from like Blavatsky or Gurdjieff and the great esoteric and mystical teachings, it provides such a richer understanding of how things could fit with the most advanced ideas in science. And at the same time, it addresses a lot of the paradoxes and the anomalies and the enigmas that confront science, as long as it applies a materialistic and mechanistic viewpoint on things.
Yeah, there's so many phenomena and enigmas that science can't explain, like all the enigmas posed by the evidences for a paranormal phenomena, like ESP or past life memory, out-of-body experiences, different forms of healing. So many phenomena that can't be explained within the main mechanistic view of science, and which demand like a deeper paradigm of understanding. So that's how I see Blavatsky's work provides the potential for a deeper model like that.
Yep. Yeah, and
it reminds me. See, another thing that strikes me though is part of the problem is. You know, scientists, there's all these divisions of science, and all the scientists become what I call little bit scientists. So there, some scientists, he's a specialist in weak vector bosons, okay, which carry the weak force, okay? So that's his specialty, and he's kind of examining things down on the quantum level, like particle level. Okay, so he may notice certain principles evident in his area of study, but to jump from a study of elementary particle interactions to considering huge quantum systems like human beings or objects of everyday life, like that's such a huge jump, and that's what people don't know how to breach. Like how can you go from arguing that two quanta that are interrelated, how does that apply to human beings, for instance? And I'd give an example of this, and I think the best example might be a mother and child. At one point, a child growing in the mother's womb is connected to the mother's heart and blood flow. And in a way, they form one organism, and they differentiate from a singlet state, and then that child grows apart in life. And suppose that child grows up and at some point, some night, has an accident on the highway and dies or is near death, and all of a sudden the mother wakes up at home and knows that something has happened to her son or daughter. Now, I would say, in a way, that's action at a distance. And I would say that just like those two quanta can be interrelated, so the mother and child in a higher dimensional phase space, they're part of one field. So that they are interconnected, although removed from each other in external four dimensional space time. But on another level, in higher dimensions, they're part of one living system. So that's an example of trying to jump from a particle level to, you know, what is entanglement, not at the level of particles, but in terms of human beings. You know, so you might have a mother and child related, or you could have identical twins, and you find all these identical twins raised apart, and they build the same type of circular seat around a tree in their front yard. They kind of do the same things and in a way are so similar, have so many kind of synchronous parallels between their lives.
Yeah.
And it's like they're interconnected and part of one system the whole time.
Well, there's many Aboriginal tribes too that the literature tends to suggest that they had psychic connections, and that, you know, I mean, it's such a different way of living from the modern industrialized way. Like, I mean, even in terms of, like, they don't live in electrical fields, you know. It's funny, like, we never really think about that. What are the effects of living in these complex, enormous electrical fields, how that's affected human consciousness, you know? I mean, versus somebody who lives more directly and in touch with nature, you know, could have such radically different types of experiences. It's interesting you say that about the mother and child. I was watching, you know, people always talk about birds, flocks of birds flying, yeah, you know, and how they change direction. I was watching the other day, I had the sprinkler on the back lawn, and I was watering my lawn, and the birds like to come, and they have a little bird bath out there, and they like to come, and they like to shower, and they like to eat on the lawn. There's about 40 sparrows out there, and one of my cats came out and started, you know, looking at them with malicious intent, and he just sort of moved very gradually, and all of a sudden, all 40 birds got up and left at the same time, just like it was so synchronous that, you know, you couldn't doubt that there was some sort of commonality of purpose and intention. There's no other way to explain it, you know, but how did they all move at exactly the same time, you know?
It's like they share that group consciousness.
Yeah, like that field consciousness, you know? I mean, it was just, like, so striking to me that, you know, I mean, you'd have to kind of, to sort of deny that, you'd have to sort of try to think your way out of it rather than taking, you know, what's sort of staring you right in the face is that, you know, and I don't think that's an illusion. I think that's very much inherent in animal groups like that, you know, like I think there's all sorts of evidence to suggest that.
Yeah, Sheldrake calls it morphogenic fields.
Right, yeah.
He gives the example of how, for instance, if you teach a group of rats a certain maze-solving problem, say in England, and then if you tried to teach that same maze learning to other groups of rats in other parts of the world, well, then as you do that, it's easier and easier for the rats to learn that maze, and somehow they benefit from other specimens of their own species having learned the maze.
Yeah.
So it's like there's a group mind, and they're all part. It's like they're all atoms of great rat.
Well, and that there's some sort of inheritance in terms of a field which informs future generations. I mean, that really goes back to work in the 20s that the American psychologist William McDougall did. He observed that. That's what part of his reference was, is to McDougall. There's another phenomena that I think he describes about these little birds in northern England, the tits, which were during the Second World War, they changed the milk delivery. They changed from having metal tops or tin tops on top of the milk bottles to cardboard, and the birds learned that they could peck through the cardboard and start drinking the milk. So this was happening all over, you know, because people's milk was delivered in those days it was left on the doorstep, eh? So the birds were drinking the milk. And he described how that practice stopped. I guess this was pre-war, and then during the war it stopped. And then, so all those, that generation of birds had died out, and then they was reintroduced after the war. And the phenomena started happening again, but it was also happening like in Norway and Denmark and places which were far distant. Like these birds live in a very, you know, circumscribed area. They don't migrate, and they don't move around very much. And yet, you know, somehow this was passed on.
I guess that's related to the expression the hundredth monkey phenomenon.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's the same. It's the same
where monkeys on one island supposedly
washing potatoes.
Story. They learned how to wash nuts or something in the
potatoes.
Oh yeah,
sweet potatoes.
Somehow that was transferred to monkeys on other islands.
Yeah, there's been some challenge to the authenticity of that story, but I mean, I think there's enough examples like Sheldrake's work, certainly. You know, where he cites there were several examples. Like this isn't sort of the idea of morphogenic fields too. Like I was reading about that a little while ago. Is that it's not something that he came up with, but it was around in the 20s and then sort of died out, like that idea sort of went out of fashion. And kind of came back when he reintroduced it. But I mean, there's so many phenomena like that. I mean, you were talking about, you know, various paranormal phenomena, out of body experiences and things that, but I mean, the most basic thing is that really a mechanistic viewpoint can't explain life or consciousness, you know, like in their most basic elements. You just, there's this quantum leap from supposedly dumb, insentient matter all of a sudden organizes itself and has consciousness. Now, how does that consciousness and life, how does that happen? You know,
yeah.
I mean, that's the fundamental enigma that confronts the materialist and the mechanistic viewpoint in science, and really nobody can explain it. And you can call it an emergent property, but that doesn't really explain anything. It's just a label to bridge a gap that you can't explain.
Yeah, and
you know, like Sperry says that about the brain, that there are higher order brain functions, higher order levels of mind, and downward causation in the brain. Well, that's right, but he says it's an emergent property, but that doesn't explain anything. That just substitutes one mystery for another, you know.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting difference. That's the difference in the way I see between religion and science, in a way. Religion maintains that, in a way, life comes from above, or life comes from within, without, I would say.
Yeah.
That it emerges from within, without. And so, in a religious view, life isn't produced by material processes which produce life. Instead, life emerges and then it organizes and produces material processes. But the material processes come from life rather than life coming from material processes. So, it's like in psychology. Like, I maintain in my work that a human being has this divine element within the higher dimensional physics of the heart, and the light of this element is like the inner consciousness within us, and it is also the life principle that brings life and animates the heart and generates the heartbeat. So I'm suggesting that each human being has this kind of higher dimensional nature to the human heart, and that's how life comes into the body. You are ensouled through the heart and through the blood flow in the body. So the living entity, in a way, inhabits the body. It is not produced by the body. And when the person dies, the consciousness withdraws from the body, but the consciousness persists because it never was produced by the material body. So the body is only a vehicle for awareness within certain space-time material world.
It's interesting too, because that what you were just saying about it withdraws from the body. Now that's a phenomena. That's a theoretical explanation, which is much more an accurate description, or much more in keeping with phenomena like the near-death experience. You know, when people are pronounced clinically dead, and when they flatline in terms of their brain functioning, and yet they still experience themselves, you know, as themselves, but now that they're out of their bodies, and you know that the famous tunnel, the tunnel of light, and everything that people repeatedly describe. Now, the skeptical materialist mechanistic explanation of that phenomena is to try to reduce it to a variety of physical causes which produce anomalous phenomena. And so you have people saying, they're deprived of oxygen, so it's an artifact of the fact that people are anoxic. But when you really start to look at the material explanations, none of them are very satisfactory. And the other problem is that you have this recurrent, consistent description of this experience. Now, that constitutes evidence where I come from. And yet, in your explanation, and I would say that in your work, this is something I see in your work that I don't see in other people's, when you talk about the heart doctrine, when you talk about the heart as being the source of consciousness in the body, you withdraw into your heart. Like, you don't withdraw into your brain, eh? Like,
no.
And so it's really quite consistent with these very anomalous phenomena. But then on top of it, it's like this whole experience of light Well, that's entirely consistent with a variety of altered states of consciousness from a variety of sources, whether it's taking hallucinogenic drugs or doing breathing exercises or doing meditation or, you know, the esoteric and mystical traditions, I mean, which have existed for thousands of years consistently, you know, or spontaneous experiences of illumination. Consistently, people describe light, you know. They don't describe anything else but light in many cases, and this light has this intelligence and this quality to it, which it reassures people about. Aldous Huxley describes it as the essential all rightness of things, and people, you know, have transformative experiences because of experiencing this light in terms of their whole attitude towards their life. Now, That's not just an enigma or a mystery or anomaly. That's a fact that has to be dealt with.
Yeah.
And the you know, contemporary science is at a complete loss. And really, the more they try to explain it, the stupider they sound. That's my interpretation of it, because it's just like, it's nonsensical when people try to explain it. Oh, well, it's this, it's that. Well, no, it's something that's beyond your frame of reference. That's what you're having trouble, you know, dealing with. And it's pointing to the validity of spiritual and religious traditions in terms of that there is a spiritual element, a divine element in human beings, and you have to, you know, you have to kind of accept that. I mean, the other side of it too is just one comment I'd like to make. When you said in religious traditions, I mean, yes and no. In terms of religion, would be my response to that, because I see, like, in a lot of religious teachings, that especially like in the Judeo-Christian tradition during the Middle Ages, they sort of locked themselves into this very fundamentalist dogmatic explanation of things, which I think is really quite divorced from the unity of religious ideals that is underlies all the great religions, and which I think is based on more the genuine mystical and spiritual experience. So I think that part of the reason why science was so successful in confronting religion is because religion had become so, in the West, had become so dogmatic and so locked into, like, I would say, very mistaken ideas about the nature. Like, you don't hear people in the Christian or Jewish tradition describing the heart doctrine. You know, it's there, but they don't understand it. Like, I mean, you're not going to hear it if you check into the local synagogue or church, you know. Like, I mean, but it's there in the Kabbalistic tradition, it's there in the Christian mystic tradition. And I'd say, like, that the churches in general represent, well, I would say, deviated religious and spiritual octaves, and they're farther and farther from the source of things, and they haven't revitalized themselves, and that's part of the problem of why so many people turn away from religion. Like, religion's kind of the worst enemy of people becoming religious, in a sense. It's like Gurdjieff's father used to say, if you want to lose your religion, make friends with a priest, you know. I mean, that's been my personal experience, you know. I just couldn't see any validity in the religious tradition I was brought up in, and yet I would say I'm a profoundly religious person now, but not because of any traditional religious teaching.
Yeah. So it all points to the need anyway for a deeper multidimensional model of the nature of human existence.
Yes,
that's what I would say. We need a higher dimensional model of human existence, and we need to develop our understanding of concepts of higher space dimensions. That things are sustained through higher space dimensions.
One point too about, I was going to make an observation, a comment about your interpretation of things, your model of consciousness, is that, and you know, I brought this up on previous shows a few times, and when we were talking with Odin, you know, I tried to sort of lead into it one show when we were talking with Odin, and it kind of got deviated. But see, what I don't see in other people's interpretations of mystical and esoteric literature is what you're suggesting, is that there's a zero point center within human beings, but also within within galaxies and within world orders, eh? Like that,
yes.
this is in a sense how people are, human beings are a microcosm of the macrocosm. I think this is a very, very, very profound and interesting idea.
The zero point centers, these are the portals,
right,
by which higher dimensional influences manifest within the physical world. So zero points are those kind of portals between the physical and the metaphysical worlds. So I'm saying it's out of the levels of divine mind and intelligence in the higher dimensional space, those influences emerge from zero point sources, from a life center within the living being.
Right.
So if this is true, for instance, the enigma in biology is how do all the cells in different parts of the body know what they're supposed to differentiate into, whether it be liver cells or pancreas cells or whatever. How do the cells know? And no one can find a place from whence it is all organized. Instead, it seems to work as a whole, okay?
Yeah.
So I would say, well, yeah, that's because there's this higher dimensional field, information field, underlying and sustaining all the material processes of the body. So the influence of why one cells become liver cells, that is determined by this deeper field that sustains the whole. So everything, all the cells of the body are part of one living whole in the higher dimensional physics of the field.
So you're saying that the problem of morphology in biology is really, if you look at it and strictly in a material level, you're not going to be able to solve the problem because the source of intelligence which sustains these things is actually not on the physical level, it's in the higher dimensional.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the example, that's why I liked Odin's example he used a couple weeks ago, where he, like, imagine you had a sheet of paper,
right,
and you dropped some iron filings on that sheet of paper. Now, what if all of a sudden you saw those iron filings all stand up and assume a certain position? And then you look under the paper and you see there's a magnet there.
Yeah.
Okay, so the idea is that the magnet creates an underlying field. So then the particles of the iron filings, because of the magnetic field underlying, which is invisible to us, You know, we can't see that field, and yet it's within space, okay? And it's an information field, okay? So when you drop the iron particles into an information field, then they assume certain pattern. So I'm saying similarly, there's information fields underlying the body and sustaining the material processes.
Yeah, I mean, and I completely agree, and as I said, I've mentioned this before, but it seems to me like there's a basic problem that confronts us all in terms of biology, is that, in the human organism, you have all these cells, but I don't know what the number is, it's something like a million billion cells or a thousand billion cells, a lot of cells. More than the stars in the galaxies, but most of them are dying they're dying and being regenerated, and all of the cells in the human body turn over. I mean, I forget, different areas. It's like, I think in the liver they turn over in like very quickly, and in the skin it's something like 180 days. I mean, that's the thing, is if you and I haven't seen one another for 6 months, all the cells in our faces that were there 6 months ago, they're all gone. Yet we're going to recognize one another because the new cells have taken up the respective positions and retain the form. And this is the thing, too. This just kills me about it. This is so interesting, is that, you know, the physical, I have a scar on my arm, so the skin cells are gone from my arm. It's a 50-year-old scar, but the new cells that are replacing it are going to remember that those are scar cells, you know. So what's going on that does this, you know? I mean, this is like life and consciousness. How do we explain this coherence, and also the other side, the coherence of the physical body, and also like that there's some sort of programmed aging of the body, so that, you know, over time, it's, you know, we know that the body is going to break down in certain predictable ways, you know, and it's so fascinating, but it's not really explicable, I would say, strictly in a material sense. I just don't understand how people don't kind of aren't more bothered by that. That to me seems to be such an essential enigma about the human body, is that it's not explicable at all in terms of the physical level, in terms of mechanistic and material processes. But, you know,
You go into like the deepest issues, like what is the nature of consciousness?
Yeah.
And then you see how they don't know at all what consciousness is, where it's produced, how to define it. Like it's. And it's really only assumptions that they think that it's produced by the brain and the head.
Yeah.
So when it comes to that most important question, it's like no one really has any knowledge of that.
Yeah.
Any deep knowledge. I would say they have only a misunderstanding of what consciousness is and how to approach its study.
And really, when you look at, you know, in doing this book, I've been reading quite a bit about the history of science in the last 300-400 years. And you really look at how things developed, and you realize that, you know, it's quite a myth that really science is just the triumph of rationality and methodological rigor and descriptions of what's out there, you know, as reality. I mean, it's quite a myth that this all has occurred as a result of reason and rationality. I mean, it's resulted because of a lot of arbitrary choices and ideologically driven choices and suppression of evidence and denial of realities that don't fit into an explanatory framework that people have adopted. And you, I guess what I see more and more is I just see, like I would say, especially the latter part of the 20th century, like, you know, you've over the years used Carl Sagan as kind of your foil for presenting your work in terms of your disagreements with science, because Sagan is, you know, is representative of the conventional mechanistic materialistic viewpoint and also atheistic viewpoint. I mean, denies the reality of any kind of spiritual divine principle in human beings or spiritual divine realities. But really, when you look at it more closely, you realize the people who adhere to that framework don't even sort of grasp the import of what's happened in science in the 20th century. I mean, I see that in Sagan's work, how he kind of completely ignores the implications of everything that happened in the first half of the 20th century in terms of physics, you know, and then, I mean, mainstream physics, the greatest minds of the first half of the 20th century all kind of realized that this mechanical explanation of nature just isn't comprehensive. It's very good at describing things within a certain limited parameters, but it breaks down, you know, when you get to the very small, or when you get to the very, when you speed up closer to the speed of light, everything kind of disintegrates into either relativity theory or quantum mechanics and physics. But there's even that has its limits, you know, like you can't go, you get to the, you referred to earlier, like to the Planckian units, and you realize that something beyond the very small exists, which is tied to physical reality, and that's what we have to try to understand.
Yeah.
And
it's like Blavatsky says, she says, any physics carried far enough leads to a metaphysics.
Yeah.
And I would say that's true, that like you have the physics of the everyday life, like physics of matter and energy within time and space, and all that kind of science of that material world. But if you carry that far enough to understand its roots, it leads into a deeper metaphysics. So like when you see a four-dimensional space-time is somehow created out of or surrounding a seven-dimensional hyperspace. So the four-dimensional kind of, you go down to zero-point levels and you're into seven-dimensional hyperspace.
Yeah.
That there's a higher dimensional physics in seven-dimensional hyperspace underlying the physics manifested in four-dimensional space-time.
Yeah.
So we need to develop our concepts of higher dimensional space. It's just such a different framework of understanding. It takes a long time to kind of understand it and consider it, and then to try to directly experience some of what we're talking about, which, you know, in ways are very heady ideas, but which ideas often correspond to things you can directly experience.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a very good point, because because of the nature of the program we're doing, and you know, because we're kind of oriented intellectually, because we are oriented intellectually in our exploration of these things on the air, and in our work as writers, and you know, I mean, you have to remember that really all of this is based on this perspective of the esoteric and mystical tradition is based on a whole set of practices that lead to experiences which are can be translated into intellectual and rational discourse, but really have a whole other level of understanding and knowledge, which is not intellectual and which is not sensory motor. I mean, it's faculties of human mind that are above and beyond the normal ways of knowing things.
Yeah, like for instance, like just as example, see, I would say that in a way we need to understand consciousness as light.
Right.
Okay, so a person might hear that as an idea. Oh, yeah, consciousness is light. Okay, and then they might have that as an idea that consciousness is light. And if someone asks them, what is consciousness, they can remember it and say, oh, consciousness is like light.
Yeah.
Okay, now, so there's that one level of understanding. But then the idea of consciousness as light is something that can be directly experienced in yourself. When you have moments of awakening or realization, or you can have experiences of the inner light and,
right.
and enhancement of the inner light within yourself. So it's direct experience of that inner light and then enhanced experiences of that inner light that allow you to be aware of so much more simultaneously in this greater light. So as you study that as a mystical process, the idea of consciousness and light, we're trying to be light gaining and attain higher states of consciousness through attaining more of this inner light. So then as you have experiences and over time and you have experiences of enlightenment or illumination that then really show you more and more consciousness as light, how important that is. And it's not just an intellectual concept, but it's something you can have direct experiences of. So that's one idea that I think really illustrates that, is that the ideas point to something beyond themselves, and we need to kind of remember that and try to attain to direct experiences of this. Or the other example, like where I say consciousness, the heart doctrine.
Right.
And I argue that our true life center is connected to the heart, the spiritual heart, which kind of lays behind the material heart, but it's through the heart and the blood that life and consciousness come into the material body. And so this is a concept, an idea of the heart doctrine. And so I argue that consciousness can be distributed all through our body. It's not just in the head, like they assume in modern science. Everybody assumes all our awareness of being is up in the head. But there's no evidence for that at all. And it's completely inconsistent with our own self-experience. So I take the heart doctrine, and then if we study the idea of the heart, and the heart in the human being is the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times the volume of that electromagnetic volume of the brain in the head. So really, the heart is the center of a human being as a quantum system, because that's the source of electromagnetic vitality that brings life into you as a living being. And the heart forms well before the mind forms. The mind forms much later within an embryo than does the heart. That's how the Dalai Lama describes all life growing out from the heart through 72,000 nadis, he says, like channels of energy, all in the subtle anatomy. So this idea, of the psychology of the heart, and then so those can just be ideas, but then we can have deeper and deeper experiences of what those ideas are pointing to. And so experiencing consciousness throughout ourself and experiencing how it's connected to blood flow. And so all of these ideas can be made concrete through your own self-study and self-awareness. That makes them really quite unique as a set of teachings about consciousness.
Yeah, and the idea that experiences of higher states of consciousness involve the opening of the heart, and not just, it's not thinking in the brain, but there's actually knowledge that is centered in your heart. And if your heart is open, you know, we have so many expressions in our language which reflect this, but if you open your heart and develop these higher states of consciousness, they're actually centered in the heart rather than in the head, which is, I think, you know, one of the really profound differences between the mystical and esoteric tradition and the modern scientific understanding of consciousness.
And at the same time, the mystical tradition says there are higher centers in the mind.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but even those, it's like you want to awaken in the heart, and the light of the self within the heart, what Blavatsky calls the Buddhic consciousness,
yeah,
then that can illuminate the mind or the higher faculties of the mind or the manas.
This is what I was trying to get at a few shows back when we were talking with Odin, and I asked him, you know, if he knew of any other theorists in consciousness research who express ideas, your understanding of things. And he mentioned Irvin Laszlo, who's a couple of books I've read now by him, very, very interesting guy, and very integrated perspective on things. And Fritjof Capra, the author of The Tao of Physics and The Turning Point and other books. And you know, I mean, Capra really doesn't discuss it. I would say doesn't really have a model of consciousness. I mean, he certainly speaks of about the parallels between modern physics and ancient esoteric and religious ideas. And Laszlo, I think, is presents a much more integrated model of consciousness, drawing on multidisciplinary fields and addresses enigmas and anomalies within these fields, and certainly presents a very interesting idea. But he does not speak of consciousness in terms of the heart. He talks about it in terms of in your terminology, the head doctrine. And then I've been reading quite a bit of Ken Wilber lately, and I've been, you know, a very interesting guy. I mean, very scholarly guy, a great writer about consciousness, and I mean, probably knows, you know, in terms of just knowing a lot, he probably knows as much as anybody alive about philosophy and religion and science. But it's funny, like, the heart doctrine is not in his work either.
No, it's not.
It's not there at all. And I mean, and in fact, at times, like, he says, you know, he's contrasting the three classic, like, the eye of the mind, the eye of the senses, and the eye of contemplation as the three traditional ways of knowing, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And he says the eye of these are different realms, and he says people make mistakes in trying to mix them. And he says, you know, like the eye of contemplation is just as valid as the eye of the senses, which is, and the eye of the mind, which is what science is based on. And, you know, I mean, I completely agree with a lot of the things he says, but one of the things he says is that, you know, in modern science, as overcame a lot of traditional religious things because it established knowledge which was dependent upon brain process and brain structures, and which invalidated religious teachings because they had no explanation of this. And I'm thinking, well, A, I don't agree with that interpretation that modern science has established these things are in the brain, and B, I don't agree that religious teachings don't have some understanding of this. I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah, or even that they would deny that there would be memory and such faculties in the mind. I don't think they would argue that at all. It's not.
I kind of find that really surprising in his work, and I really find it odd that he doesn't sort of address the heart doctrine.
Yeah,
you know, because from your work, what's astonishing to me is how it's consistently articulated throughout the mystical and esoteric literature, and it's in basically every religious teaching, except people don't understand it. They don't.
Yeah, within those traditions.
Yeah, within those traditions, they don't recognize what's being said. It's like when Gurdjieff says about, you know, sometimes people just. They think things are meant metaphorically, but they're actually meant literally. Like he said, I'm often asked why these ideas about human beings being living in a state of waking sleep are not in the Gospels. He said they're all through the Gospels, you know, awake, watch, you know, those are referring to wake up, you know. That's meant literally. That's not a metaphor, you know. And that's part of the problem is that until you have the frame of reference to understand these things, you can't really grasp what's being said sometimes when it's staring you right in the face. But as I say, I find that very peculiar. And I mean, I disagree respectfully with Odin because I don't think, I've read more of Laszlo. He doesn't articulate the heart doctrine. And there's no mention of although he talks a great deal about the quantum vacuum and consciousness, and I think it's quite consistent with your work and with that of others, there's no mention of zero points, and I would say that your, you know, hypothesis about zero points is existing on both human beings and on the level of worlds is I think that's a very, very, you know, unique interpretation of things, and I think a very provocative idea. It's like, I mean, it's certainly worth exploring and trying to understand it more deeply, you know?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it's so valuable. Yeah, it's funny, like, I looked, another writer is Lynn McTaggart, and
right.
She writes about the kind of zero-point fields and such.
Yeah.
So she writes about, like, the new concepts of the quantum vacuum as void and plenum and such, and there being these different subtle fields, but she never conceives that a human being might have a zero-point center.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know anyone else exactly saying that. It's definitely not in the way that I argue it and try to explain that this teaching.
Yeah, and along the same lines, too.
I mean, it's inherent in Blavatsky. I mean, that's what I'm saying, too.
I would say another thing, too, that, I mean, and this is, I think, is something that's extremely valuable from the Gurdjieff teaching, is how he articulates the law of three as a fundamental cosmic law.
Yeah.
And says that, you know, that everything is the production of three forces, an active, passive, and the neutralizing forces, and that sometimes, you know, in our normal state of consciousness, we're third force blind because we tend to think, the literal mind tends to see everything in terms of dualities. There's this and there's that. There's one thing and there's the other. And you see that this, I think, is a very valuable contribution from your original, you know, from your PhD thesis, is that you see it all through psychological literature where somebody comes up with with a concept, and then its opposite completes the whole by you know, there's one thing and then there's everything else. And it just so happened that when you were writing about that, that was during the whole kind of split brain fever that occurred when people discovered hemispheric lateralization, or the two modes of consciousness, as it was sometimes called, the left brain, right brain, eh?
Yeah.
So you had every possible human attribute being assigned to the left brain, and its opposite being assigned to the right brain. But even in terms of these divisions, people were completely inconsistent in terms of, like, defining what these attributes were and what their opposites were. But that's where the Gurdjieff teaching is so valuable, is identifying this idea that everything's the interaction of three forces, because I see that in a lot of people who are familiar even with esoteric and mystical literature and who are espousing these viewpoints, how they fall into what Gurdjieff calls formatory thinking, which is thinking of the path of least resistance. There's this and there's that, and
dualistically,
and always think
all the
dualistically
time.
Is in the terms of these twosomes, and that's not to deny that there aren't dualities. You know, there are all sorts of dualities. Well, yes and no. I mean, in life, but that really, to get a more comprehensive picture, we have to try to look for the third force and try to understand things as the third force, and it's such a useful way to look at things critically. I like to tell.
Oh, it is so invaluable. It's incredibly valuable to have that concept of the law of three.
Yeah,
whenever you have the duality, there's always a third force that is kind of a unifying principle or a third element that brings it, that completes it as a whole.
Yeah. Sometimes it's the medium itself is the third force, or you know, but it's just so useful to go beyond just thinking in twos, and you see it all the time how people fall into this and
thinking in twos. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I would say the same thing about Gurdjieff's idea about the law of seven or the law of octave, which I referred to earlier, which essentially says that there's no process unfolds in a continuous fluid manner, that there are inherent discontinuities in everything, and that at certain points in the progression of any octave, he calls the notes, like for the different steps, that there are two points where there are intervals which have to be filled by some sort of an external shock or some sort of force which can continue the process. Otherwise, the octave will deviate or will stop or will be distorted. Now, you can apply that to any variety of things. I mean, in a sense, in terms of physics, he was describing like quantum processes, I would say, like the discontinuity of things is referring to quantum leaps. But also, like in terms of, like he says, and take the example of religious teachings, like all the religions, he said, originate from esoteric teachings. And so the religion starts to grow. But then as it unfolds, there are different points where for some reason the octave isn't filled properly, so it starts to distort or is deviated. And he says, like, take, for example, Christianity. Is that think of how many deviations would have had to occur to go from Jesus' teachings on the Sermon on the Mount and the teachings of his parables of peace and love and brotherhood to the Inquisition, you know, in the Middle Ages, or the burning of witches, or you know, the Scholastics and the
what's
being done in our age. I mean, think of the octave of democracy, you know.
The octave of democracy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the things that. But as he said, the thing about deviated octaves is that they still preserve the same name. So, I mean, I think this is a thing that whenever I'm reading about religion and science, I'm thinking, well, what religion and what science are you talking about? I mean, Gurdjieff said everything can be distinguished by the level of consciousness involved. And so he said when people talk to him about art or philosophy or religion or whatever, he knew exactly what he meant by these things, but he had to talk with them for quite a while to find out what they meant, because people use the same words to describe essentially different phenomena. And I would say in religion, like when people say, well, there's religion and there's science, well, I would say there's a whole spectrum of religions in terms of the degrees of consciousness and a whole spectrum of science in terms of the degree of consciousness of it. And I would say that a lot of the disagreement, so-called, is people babbling because there's a confusion of tongues, because they don't really understand that they're using the same words to describe essentially different things.
Yeah. Just to go back here and pick up on a couple things that you've been saying. So I think it's profoundly important to understand this concept of the law of three. And I think comparing common thought is always dualistic.
Mm-hmm.
Left brain, right brain, head, heart, science, religion, the body and the material body and the immaterial soul. The body and the mind, always dualistic, matter and energy in time and space, with waves and particles, observers observed, all the dualities of existence. Whereas mystical teaching suggests all things have a threefold nature, and it also suggests all things have a sevenfold nature. So in mystical teachings, the basic model, mathematical model of creation is the one is divided by three and yields seven. And that's all analogous to if you took white light divided by a three-sided prism and got a spectrum of seven colors. So whereas modern thought is dualistic, always seeing things twos in everything, mystical thinking in a way, as I see it, is this pattern of 1, 3, 7.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really profound concept of this 1, 3, 7-fold nature. And to try to apply that kind of thinking, like I do in my writing, I try to apply that to give examples of it, you know, in terms of a human being as having a monadic essence in the heart. And then it's the energies from there are distributed through the three main channels and seven chakras.
Right.
So there's an inner circulation of light in the human being. Or another example, the material world is composed of protons, electrons, and neutrons, three elements, and they compose seven rows of elements in the periodic table. So again, we find the 1, 3, 7 pattern. And I could give numerous other examples. Yeah. So in mystical teachings, they provide this kind of alternative way of like trying to interpret the data of science differently. Like in psychology, another example, psychology for the past century was defined as the science of behavior and the mind, as though we have a mind in the head and the body, dualistic. Whereas Gurdjieff says we function mentally, emotionally, and physically, head, heart, and hands. So we have a threefold nature, not simply a mind and a body. Okay, so they denied the heart and soul. So to learn to think in threes and to understand, you know, to study this principle of the law of seven or the law of the octave and its application, these are such valuable teachings.
Yeah, and it sort of counters the, I mean, a couple of things. It's like, one, it's like, you know, if you ask somebody, well, do you believe in intelligent design? I'd say, yeah, I believe in intelligent design, but what do you mean by that? Because I know what I mean by that, and I think it's probably quite different from what is generally thought. I mean, the other thing, too, is that Carl Sagan, in the varieties of scientific experience, his lectures on natural theology at the University of Edinburgh, he says that really, and this is something he says throughout his work, but he says that in those particular lectures that in his mind, you know, the religious teachings don't really put forward any essential ideas about the nature of things that are consistent and that can be tested. But I mean, I would say that, well, I think the law of three is in every religious teaching. I mean, I think that it's there. I don't know that he recognizes, and I would say that there are all sorts of different elements in the essence of religious teachings that are there, that are consistent and that tell us something very profound and you know, interesting about the nature of our being and the nature of the universe and how we can relate to it.
Yeah, I agree, absolutely. I mean, I see the one corollary of the God hypothesis is the soul hypothesis. Is there a human soul or something that's beyond the material body? So the soul hypothesis is a corollary of the God hypothesis. And then the soul hypothesis ties into the question of the issue of the nature of human consciousness.
Yeah.
Is consciousness produced by material processes in the brain, which is what modern scientists assume, although they've been unable to prove it or to say what the consciousness is, or is there a higher dimensional science to consciousness as light and that it connects through the heart and it comes into a person through your heart and blood and it's connected to the life of the breath because Blavatsky sees consciousness also. It's a modification of the ceaseless breath. So there's that life principle within us. I've lost a little bit what I was trying to get to.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that the breath, because at one point Sagan's talking about spirit, and he said, well, you know, the spirit, if you're talking about the spirit of inquiry, or the spirit, he said, I believe in that spirit, but, you know, and I'm thinking, well, it's funny, wow. because yeah, but, you know, he said, but there's not really any explanation, and I'm thinking, well, actually, you know, spirit, pneuma, refers to the breath, and
yeah.
That's a fundamental,
yeah.
that's where his, like, that's a perfect example of his very fundamentalist, you know, literal interpretation of spirit. You know, he thinks that it refers to some immaterial mental process or emotional process that arises out of his brain, but the concept of spirit is related to the breath, and of course the concept of breath is related to the disciplines of learning how to breathe, which in turn, like in the yogic teachings, is you know, Yogananda describes how master yogis in the Kriya yogi tradition can saturate their tissues with light, you know, which is essentially the light of consciousness, so that they actually change the electromagnetic nature of the body through breathing and experience these higher states of consciousness. So, I mean, just in a couple of quick steps, you can go from the idea of spirit as some sort of metaphorical description of a mental emotional process that arises out of the brain, which is Sagan's interpretation, to spirit as some sort of fundamental spirit as some sort of fundamental essence of the universe, which human beings are capable of knowing, but have to do through practicing certain disciplines, which are not mental disciplines.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and spirit is something that moves us, like spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, spirit. Yeah,
inspired. I was thinking of the word inspired,
to breathe
how that's related to the breath.
Yeah.
Like, it's interesting in Blavatsky, she describes how she's in the stanzas of Jan, the mystical poetry upon which the secret doctrine is based. It says, the suns expand and contract through their own hearts and selves.
Mm.
Each in turn becomes a part of the web, of spirit and matter spun. So you expand and contract through your own selves and hearts. So this is suggesting that there's some kind of higher dimensional physics by which a self connects through the heart into the body, and the self comes into the body, and as you approach death, the kind of self withdraws from the body or is established in higher dimensions. Okay, so
well, there. I mean, you know, just to backtrack a little bit, like to Sagan's point that, you know, religious teachings don't suggest anything. I mean, higher dimensions. Ken Wilber points out in his work and quotes. I mean, Houston Smith, actually, the religious writer, theologian, says that realistically, it's just in the last couple hundred years with the advent of modern science that people have stopped believing in the, you know, what was once known as the great chain of being, or, and Wilber says actually a better description is maybe the great nest of being, which with each level is successively of reality is nested in a higher reality which subsumes and that adds on to it, you know, and this is really the only, it's just with the advent of modern science, this is the first time that people have not believed in that it runs, like the idea of hierarchy runs throughout all of human history. That's just really only in the last couple of hundred years that, you know, that conventional thinkers, modern thinkers, have stopped believing this, and
believing in the existence of other worlds that consciousness might pass into.
Yeah,
like it's not only going down a tunnel into a realm of light. It's also
being
within lower realms of lost souls,
or
kind of torturous places, or states of confusion and kind of illusory worlds. That
like the White House.
Yeah, Oliver, you're right.
Why didn't you start describing that? I thought, gee, that sounds familiar. Lost of tortured souls, realms of illusion and delusion. Yeah, but I mean, you know, the point is that realistically, it's funny. Like, there's kind of that's scientism in the sense of like elevating science to this all encompassing way of knowing everything about reality. You know, and people like Carl Sagan and Richard Dawkins who just sort of deny all, you know, the whole kind of history of human seeking knowledge that because it in practice science as it's currently practiced that they don't know anything, which is really, you know, really quite arrogant and really a vast oversimplification. And well, it's not only a vast oversimplification, it's basic ignorance of what these ideas entail.
Well, I do think we've lost the esoteric principles that are embodied in religious teachings.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's what I say is the heart doctrine is in all the basic esoteric religious teachings and all the different religions. So that unifies the religions. And I would say, yeah, as you said, say they all postulate like a hierarchy of levels of existence.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all postulate that, and I would argue also that they all have these principles of the laws of 3 and 7, I think, are throughout the mystical teachings.
Yeah.
So these are the esoteric elements in these teachings, and that's what's not. Instead, we kind of took the outer form of religion, and as you said before, the octaves of religion deviated. You know, we went from the true Christ teaching to kind of, you know, almost satanic influence and, you know,
yeah,
of the churches and religions.
Yeah,
you know,
and I mean,
false teaching that came up, and, you know, now Christians support the wars.
They're
completely deluded by their pseudo-religion.
I mean, a large part of why religion is so discredited. I mean, Christianity is discredited amongst a lot of quote-unquote intelligent people because Christians are always going around murdering everybody in the name of Christ, you know, which really shows that it's easy to draw the conclusion from that Christianity is vacuous and that there's nothing to it or that it's a big myth. I mean, it's a classic case of throwing the baby out with the bathwater because, I mean, I agree with people who are critical of fundamentalists and who are critical of people who put forward hateful messages in the name of religion. I think those people are completely wrong. You know, whether they're Christians or Jews or Muslims or any other religion, they're just wrong. Like, you know, that you can't justify on a religious basis killing anybody. I'm sorry, it's not in a religious teaching.
And all the religions would agree with that in a way that you wouldn't behave so unrighteously.
Yeah. I mean, religion means to unite. It doesn't mean to divide, and it certainly doesn't mean to kill, you know.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, just getting back to, like, you know, what you're saying about the law of 3 and the law of 7, and, well, I mean, the idea of everything ultimately being unified and coming from the one, and also just the idea of knowing God. Like, I mean, when we say to know God, or when people describe being at one with the universe, I mean, skeptics take that and say, well, that's just some sort of subjective delusional or misinterpretation of some sort of anomalous experience. I mean, in a lot of cases, they don't even doubt that people have had what they think are profound experiences, but then they explain it away. But the point is that people have had the experience of knowing God and have had the experience of being one with the universe repeatedly throughout human history. And,
yeah, so
you know,
we need to understand what these
experiences
are entailing. Yeah.
Once in a while, you know, sometimes people have those experiences and they're deluded. They're, you know, they're paranoid schizophrenics, or, you know, they're having some sort of breakdown, but, or they're megalomaniacal, you know, psychotics, but there's just such profound teachings that come out of that experience that I think it's like, it's the height of, I'm trying to think of the height of denial and lack of curiosity. I guess that's what astounds me, is that why aren't people more interested in this? I think it's sort of worth looking into, don't you?
I think the debate too much has always been trying to show there's evidences for paranormal phenomena, and I think that people haven't enough taken the next step is then to ask, okay, well, let's assume all these things are true and all these evidences are indeed correct, and then we live in a multidimensional reality, and then how can we understand the nature of that and what we are in that multidimensional reality? So I think we need to, that, I guess that's how I see my work, is trying to bring a deeper understanding of how this works, in terms of a model of the physics and metaphysics of a human being.
Yeah, I guess in part what I was referring to is that it was more like the scientific attitude towards a genuine religious experience. And I mean, in the history of psychology, you really had the act of denial of the legitimacy of religious experience, whether it was Freud or whether it was the behaviorist at the turn of the 20th century, and then the behaviorist just denied all inner experience, the reality of all inner experience. And really, even today, you have people like Dennett, you know, who they call them eliminative materialists, which is really a very nice name for people who aren't too smart, as far as I can see, because they're just sort of denying the reality of any inner experience, and they think that that's philosophically progressive or scientifically advanced. It seems to me that it's based on a really concerted effort to deny so much profound human history and profound human quest to know ourselves. I don't understand it, I guess, is what
I'm saying. No, it strikes me as just childish kind
yeah,
of.
Well,
I mean, it doesn't solve the problem, because the fact of the inner experiencing, if he doesn't have that...
Well, and then on top of it, like Dennett and these guys, there's a guy who wrote a book called Consciousness Explained, which is without a doubt one of the worst pieces of garbage I've ever read in my life. It's just a completely ridiculous book. And it's really just a book on psychophysics and computation. Eh?
Wow.
And yet, these guys talk about building robots and machines that would be indistinguishable from human beings because they would have all the computational capacities of a human being. So they deny the existence of God and spiritual realities, but they think that they can make human beings or make something that so resembles a human being that essentially, you know, for all intents and purposes from the outside, they are a human being.
yeah, and they think that's
a little
computational thing.
It's funny because, on the one hand, the great thing about studying esoteric teachings for 30 years is that it really does humble you to, especially when you begin to study, you just realize you don't know anything. You really don't. And then as you go along a little further, you start to kind of gain some sense of things. But it's important to kind of remember and to be humble at times about, what you know and what you do not know. But at the same time, I find, after 30 years, I kind of get impatient with these people in the sense that I just see how limited their appreciation is of the evidence and how circumscribed their whole approach to trying to know is. And it's based on all these prejudices and on all these distortions of really essential matters that have to be addressed, and they don't want to address them, and yet they're so convinced that they have these great insights to the truth of everything, and it's just it's just really, it's very peculiar, and it's very annoying at times too. I find I have less and less patience for being humble and more just come on.
It's like no one has investigated the idea of the psychology of the heart and soul for over a century. So you have this whole kind of superficial modern psychology of consciousness simply based on assumption and misunderstanding.
Yeah.
I mean, it is discouraging. It's a huge waste. I mean, so much of modern thought is totally superficial, the mind and the body and the left brain and the right brain and the science and religion. It is so much formatory thinking, or soup, as Gurdjieff would call it.
I remember about 10, 15 years ago, seeing on the news one night, and it was something to do with, new artificial hearts or something, but this cardiac surgeon was on, and he says, you know, well, you know, people may think that...
Sorry.
Hello?
Yeah.
People may think that the heart is the seat of the soul, but it's just a mechanical pump. And
who says that?
This cardiac surgeon.
Oh, yeah.
Who was describing this new technique in cardiac surgery. And I remember talking to this friend of mine who was a doctor, and he graduated, I think, around 1980. And this is about 10 years later. And he said, well, you know, it's interesting in terms of cardiac medicine. He said, you know, when I graduated, the way that we treated heart disease was prescribing, and he started naming these different drugs. And he said, now 10 years later, it's completely the opposite. Like, the whole understanding of the physiology of the heart has completely changed in the 10 years since I've been out of medical school. And now they've gone to a completely different understanding. So, you know, at times it may seem that, you know, that we know so much about, in modern medicine, about everything in the physical body, but in a way we have, like, such major, major, still great unknowns about things, you know, like that we really don't know. And I mean, I just worked on transcribing a medical conference which dealt with a drug which was used to treat hypertension, and which is the number one killer of people in the world. It's, you know, heart disease and hypertension is still like this huge, huge problem, and there's been huge advances in Canada in educating people about, you know, trying to prevent hypertension. And this guy, who is a physician, stood up and he said, but, you know, he said, when you look at cancer, he said, cancer's really interesting because, he says, like, it seems every month there's a new announcement of some sort of breakthrough in cancer. And he said, and it seems like it's in a different city each month. But he said, in terms of life expectancy, if you go back, like, I don't know, it was 10, 15 years, 20 years, I think it's 20 years, actually. He said, really, the life expectancy for across cancers is really only increased by a few months, you know, like, whereas in heart disease, it made major inroads. And again, like, what you, I thought of this when you were talking earlier, because, like, so much cancer research involves, like, little bit science, like it focuses on, you know, cell biology and microcell biology in so many different areas, and yet we're inventing
new pharmaceuticals.
Well, exactly, and we pour so much money into it. You know, we're always having these breakthroughs, and yet really our understanding of cancer in the last 20, 30 years, in some ways, and some cancers, yeah, there's been, you know, major breakthroughs and major understanding of things, and you know, people have increased their life expectancies. But boy, I mean, it's really, like, not that much advance. I mean, part of it too is because, as like this guy pointed out, if you ask people door to door where they want the money to go in cancer research, it's into prevention. You know, to 80% people say prevention, but all the research goes into treatment. And so we, you know, we live in carcinogenic environments, and yet that involves dealing with things on a much more global and complex level. So instead we pour all this money, cancer research money, into a little bit science to research questions on the most, you know, on the smallest, simplest levels, and nothing really happens. You know, it's interesting. It's like it shows that the problem of reductionism in science, and how we have to kind of go beyond, like, beyond our, you know, our normal approach to things, I think, to really make breakthroughs in things. And I mean, that may be an area where we're trying to understand consciousness and.
Yeah, I think it would help to reduce cancer if they stopped spreading so many carcinogenic substances. You know, every time I look up, no, here's my today's chemtrails, you know. Oh, here the jets are going this way, and now they're going that way, and okay, and how long will those take? Nice clouds there.
Yeah.
You know, they spread carcinogens from above, and then they want to put in your food, and now we radiate your food, and know, have their Terminator seeds and, you know, all their delinquent stuff they do, you know.
There's an item
Everything is so interrelated into the whole corrupted criminal government and society we've ended up being in. You know, I don't think ever the evidence for the kind of massively corrupt society is so clear to any sane intelligence, you know.
Yeah, there's an item in the newspaper today, too, about that they tested the leaders of the three major political parties in Ontario, and they're all apparently got like higher than normal levels of carcinogens in each of them, eh? Like, I mean, if you test anybody, basically who lives in Ontario, you'll find that they have carcinogenic substances and levels in their bodies, which are not good.
And they tested the Canadian leaders?
Well, they tested the Premier, Dalton McGuinty, and Howard Hampton, the leader of the NDP, and who's the guy who's leader of the Progressive Conservatives, Tory. And they all have higher than normal levels, actually, which is interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, of various substances, you know. And they were discussed something that they're trying to get banned. But you know, I mean, the problem is that there, as you say, there's so many of them, you know. But then again, like what I was trying to get at earlier is like, this is part of the problem with science that is practiced in such a reductionist way, like on such a reductionist level, on such a micro level. You know, we're going to figure everything from the ground up, but you know, things are more complex than that, and there are a lot of questions that have to be, you know, within all levels of anything that you look at, there are levels within levels within levels, which is getting back to the idea of the hierarchy of things. And the problem with a lot of science today is that it's practiced only on the smallest, most simple, most manageable levels and never really deals with the holes in which things are included. And I would say that's a big problem with most medical research is, you know, yeah, it's good to understand things at a cellular level, but, you know, there are other levels that the cells are part of organs, which are part of, you know, bodies, which are part of people, which are part of, you know, environments, which are part of societies. Like, I mean, it's, you know, much more complex than that.
Yeah.
And what I was getting to about a half an hour ago was just the idea that I think in some ways that's why, like, we have to kind of go beyond the physical and try to understand things in terms of these fields. Like, I mean, this would of information and intelligence, which would inform these things, and you know, which would give us a better understanding of the mechanisms involved.
Yeah. That's what I think. There are some really valuable elements in my writings on the holographic physics of Blavatsky,
mm-hmm.
and some of this kind of model I develop of some of these processes. It's really interesting. Like, I realize in my work, like, what I'm postulating is that a human being, in a sense, does have an individual I. Like, spelt letter I.
Yeah.
Like, in a way, there is one element, like, at some center, some life element within the human being. And that this is not, like, a combination of molecules or neurons or anything like that. That there is some individual I, a zero-point center, and this is actually tied into the physics of what happens within space. And that this central eye in the person, in a way, it has spin properties. It's a monad in hyperspace, and it has spin properties. And the physics of the monad in hyperspace with its spin properties is rendered equivalent in holographic physics to particle theory on different shells surrounding the central point. So this, the idea is, imagine the central point, and then it's surrounded by one sphere, and then another sphere, and another sphere, and another sphere, all surrounding the central point. So that central point is then embodied in these different realms as these spheres form around it. So there's a model that we have these zero-point centers, and that is embodied in the hierarchy of vehicles. So it's a model of, like, the structure of the, like, I would say the quantum vacuum has seven skins. Like that, if you study Blavatsky, you would argue this, that the ether of space has seven skins. So there are seven different levels to it. It's quantized like that. So I'm kind of losing my point a bit, what I was trying to get back to.
Oh, just about how the individual, the I, is...
Yeah, so the idea of there being actually being an I, and that there's a higher dimensional physics to this. And in my work, I try to explain that, this concept of a monad in hyperspace, and how the physics of that is rendered equivalent to the physics of the particle theories surrounding that central point. It's kind of a bit too complex to get into to explain this.
Well, just one quick question. When people talk about, in modern physics, when they talk about 11-dimensional space, are they talking about the quantum vacuum as having seven higher dimensions?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So that would correspond to the seven parents, the eternal parent space Blavatsky talks about. So that's a parallel between her ideas and modern ideas of space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she postulates the seven-skinned eternal parent space as underlying the four-dimensional sun that's created out of that.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm saying that we similarly ourselves have this kind of monad in hyperspace. Okay, that we actually have some kind of quanta, a particle, a jiva atma, it would be called in yoga, divine spark in Sufism.
Right.
So we have one of these elements, and there's an actual higher dimensional physics whereby the spin properties of that element are imparted into the ethers surrounding the central point, and that breaks the symmetries in the ethers such that it creates different planes of matter surrounding the central point.
Right, and that's another idea, like of broken symmetries in modern physics. And it's interesting because that's another, like the idea of the spark is something that recurs throughout religious and metaphysical teachings. So the idea of the jiva atma, like the soul, which is a microcosm of the soul, or which is, you know, embodies spirit, or you know, can be realized as spirit. Like that recurs throughout these teachings and is kind of consistent throughout them. Speaking of which, I just wanted to mention very quickly, John Francis sent me some material on his writings on the parables.
It's your recommendation.
And I was reading them, and boy, it would be I know John listens to the show sometimes, so it would be really nice to have him on to talk. I was really impressed by his writings. It was really, really interesting, and it would be nice to have him on again to talk.
Okay, well, you will maybe even do that next week and have John on at least for half an hour
and do that as well as
the material on the physics of the secret doctrine.
Because his point is essentially, he was responding to something I had said about Maurice Nicole about his writings on the new man and his interpretations of the Gospels in terms of esoteric teachings. And John wrote me and said that perhaps I'd be interested in his interpretations. And again, he says that he arrived at these understandings through meditation and through realization of the heart, you know, which I thought was very, very interesting. And his interpretations go beyond sort of literal or scriptural, traditional scriptural interpretations, and he's trying to understand things esoterically. And very, I think, very, very interesting. It just you realize what a wealth of knowledge exists in these things that you may have heard many times, but until you've heard somebody explain them in these ways, you can't see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah, I like an example was the mustard seed in his book. He uses that like how I described there being the bliss sheet in the heart about the size of a small grape or a seed, and that idea that there is that kind of individual I element in the human being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he talked about the five bridesmaids, you know, as being the census,
and
which I thought was really interesting. I mean, it's just so many. I went back and I was reading some Maurice Nichols commentaries. It's just, you know, it's fascinating how, you know, he says there's a whole interpretation that can be based on a different understanding of you know, all the different terms like water and wine and vineyards. These things don't refer to water and wine and vineyards. They refer to essential things like knowledge and wisdom and working on yourself and you know, like they deal with the transforming consciousness and opening the heart, you know, which is
there's a whole esoteric side to religions which unfortunately has been lost. I mean, that's so tragic, really, you know. So now religion forms more you know, the reason for hatreds and such between people, you know.
Yeah.
Instead of helping to unify people in the same spiritual teachings, you know?
Yeah. And
that's very unfortunate.
You can read the Bible and pretty much find any justification for anything in there if you want to distort it and twist it. And,
So anyway, well, we're coming up to the end of the show, and any final thoughts or comments, Jim? Just take a minute here.
I hope you can get back into your writing, and you know, I look forward to you completing your work and getting it out there. And I think you know, people should visit your website, and even if you haven't visited lately, there's lots of material on there, and it's www.zeropoint.ca, and they should check it out.
Okay, and we'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll have several guests then, I just remind people, try to cultivate this awareness of awareness of consciousness within yourself. We want to learn to live more consciously and consider these ideas of be more present in your breath, in your life, and study this